Well, when it comes to playing a basketball game or a soccer game or a baseball game, something like that, my kids, who are all kind of into sports, they don't generally resist the getting ready for the actual game. But there are times, every so often, and any parent who's had a kid in sports has experienced this, I think, where the kid simply doesn't want to go to their game. And so no matter what you can do, it takes work to get ready just to leave the house to go to the game. In our house, the way that it looks, generally, because soccer is the sport that they play most often, is we say, all right, get your stuff so that we can go to the game. And almost always they say, well, I don't know where some piece of their uniform is. I don't know where my shin guards are. I don't know where the socks are. I don't know where the shirt is. I don't know where the... I mean, they can never find it. And every single time that happens, my wife and I, we say, we need a better system. We need a better system for that. We need to get them ready ahead of time. We need to do something so that we don't face this. Well, then they do find their stuff, and it turns out that one of the items of their clothing is just completely dirty, right? And so then you're like putting this jersey on with grass stains everywhere, and you're just like, we're going to be those people, you know? And you just put it on, and you get ready to go. Or sometimes it's been washed, but not dried. So then what you do is you stick it out of the window on the car ride on the way to the game to try to get it to dry. I think some of you parents have gone through this. Now, with soccer, the other wonderful thing is that there are these ridiculously long socks that aren't easy to get on. And so there's this tugging and this fighting process. And then after you get the socks on, then there comes the cleats. And the cleats are always too tight and they hurt my toes. And okay? Well, not most of the time. But when that would happen, my wife and I, we would get them in the car, you know, jersey flagging out the window kind of thing, and on our way there. And we'd get to the sidelines, and they would run out to their coaches, and they'd run out to their teammates, and they'd get the ball, start kicking, whatever. And we'd look at each other, and we're like, why are we paying for this? You know, like, why are we paying for this kind of suffering? And then the game starts. And as soon as the game starts, they're happy. And they're joyful. And they're running around. And now they're tough. You know, in the hallway at home, if their brother had bumped into their arm, you would have thought they got it cut off. It was like, oh, that hurts so bad. On a soccer field, they're getting just murdered, and they haven't watched enough pro soccer to realize that's what you're supposed to do. Hold your leg and roll around. But on the soccer field, when they get injured, they're fine. You know, at home, when there's a disappointment or something's unfair, oh, it's unfair, terrible, blah, blah, blah. On a soccer field, when a bad call is made, they're like, and then they just keep playing. It's like the joy of being in the moment and playing and letting the ref do his job, letting the coach do the job, and then just playing the game. The joy erases some of that discomfort and some of that struggle. Well, a few weeks back, we were getting our kids ready for a different sort of event. Now, before those soccer games, I'm always saying things like, guys, the game doesn't take that long. I know you're doing something, but the game won't take that long. You'll be happy when it's done. It's going to be a good time. I was giving essentially the same speech for a different event a couple weeks ago. Guys, it won't take very long. You'll be happy, you know, when it's all over with, that kind of thing. And they were like, yeah, but I can't find any clothes. Come on, let's get dressed. I'm like, finding clothes. They're not helping at all. They wanted no part of the next event, which was to get shots. Now, I said that every once in a while when we get ready for a soccer game, they're not super pumped about it. Every single time I've ever said, hey kids, we're getting shots, which maybe is the secret. I should just tell them, hey kids, we're going to get donuts. I'm like, cool. And then we get to the doctors. They're like, what's going on? Betrayed. Like, guys, we're getting shots. And sure enough, I can't find any clothes. And I don't want to do this, blah, blah, blah. And as they've gotten older, they've gotten a little tougher. Yeah, they get the 1,000-yard stare. They can mostly deal with it. And I can say to them, this is good for you. It'll be over soon. You'll be happy when it's over with. And yet, it doesn't feel good to them. It feels uncomfortable. It feels difficult. It feels like something that maybe they don't actually need. Today, we're going to be looking at a response that King David had. And it's the type of thing that if I were to just say, today, here's what we're talking about, you would go, that feels like a shot. That feels like something I'm not sure that I need. I'm not sure it makes me very comfortable. I mean, I like the word, okay. I just don't know about when it comes to my own life. I don't know that I like it. And yet our approach needs to be, to this issue, more like the soccer game. It might be a little bit uncomfortable, but when you're in the mix and you're allowing the ref to be the ref and the coach to be the coach and you're playing your part, there can be real joy in it. We're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 24. So go ahead and open up to 1 Samuel chapter 24. If you grab the Bible in front of you, it will be on page 246. We're in week 7 of our Better Days sermon series, and we've been saying all along that we all look for better days out there, better circumstances, better, we want everything just to click. But God was looking for better hearts, and he found in David a better man than King Saul. Well, these final chapters of this book, 1 Samuel, are a downward spiral. Everything is kind of just descending. It's getting worse. David is losing everything. He loses his best friend. He loses his wife, his dog, his fishing pole, his house, right? He loses everything. And there's this guy, Saul, who's the king, the one who wears the crown, but David's been anointed to be the king, but Saul's still in charge. And Saul's envy, his jealousy, becomes so pronounced that he wants nothing more than to kill David. And so he begins to chase David and tries to kill him and tries to attack him, and he gets a whole group of guys and he goes after David. And David gets this opportunity to show Saul mercy. He gets the opportunity to show Saul mercy, and mercy is where I want us to land. Mercy feels like a shot. See, mercy is a struggle for a lot of us. It is not something that we come to naturally. In fact, I mean that very literally. Nature is not very merciful, right? Have you ever watched like a nature video? The animals don't get close to eating the weaker animal and then being like, nah. Right? They don't look at each other. If an animal gets the upper hand, it takes it. And it takes it out with extreme vengeance. It doesn't care about, it doesn't just stop, it doesn't process, it doesn't show compassion. Time out. Some of you are like, my dog is very compassionate, okay? Or you've seen some TED Talk where you're like, I think there's a monkey that shows a little bit of altruism. Okay, in general, mercy is not natural. It's not something that we come to and we think, oh, that's what I want to do. We might think that's what I should do, but we never feel super pumped about it. Mercy is even harder, honestly, for those of us who've been in the faith for a little while. Jesus once told the story. It's called the Good Samaritan. Some of you might be familiar with it. But he uses different characters to describe how they responded to this person in need. And if you remember the story at all, the two people who don't respond in mercy are what? Priest and a Levite, right? A pastor and a music minister. Like, he makes up a story and he thinks, what three people would illustrate this best? The two unmerciful people are the people that would be sitting in the pews on a Sunday. The two people he chooses to use as his examples are those that are probably a bit like us. Why does he do that? Well, he does it because mercy doesn't come naturally, even to those of us who consider ourselves to be good Christians. We'd rather focus on holiness or piety or justice or something, but we miss the call of mercy and the joy of mercy. So today we're going to look at the look of mercy, the source of mercy, the people of mercy, and the joy of mercy. Here's the story. David's on the run from Saul. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all of Israel, and he went to seek David and his men in front of the Wild Goats Rocks. Sounds like a bar, right? The Wild Goats Rocks. There is this place in En-Gedi where there's these nice springs and there's these caves, and they call it the Wild Goats area because there's some pastures there near the caves, and a lot of farmers would go up there and they would tend to goats and that sort of thing, thus the Wild Goats Rocks. And David is with about 600 guys. 600 guys who are either his friends, or maybe if they're not his friends, they're at least guys who are like, well, we like him better than Saul, and one of these guys is probably going to be king. So they throw in their hat with David. Well, David's there with about 600, and they're hanging out near these springs. It makes a lot of sense for them to be near fresh water. And Saul is chasing with chosen men, men that he thought would be loyal and professional and easily capable of dispatching a group that's 5 times smaller than his own. Well, we find out that one day David is hiding in a cave. And while he's hiding in a cave, something amazing happens. So Saul came to the sheepfold, by the way, this is verse 3, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. He's not a normal person. He gets the executive bathroom, right? This is the king, people. He doesn't have to go out and dig a hole somewhere. He gets to use the cave. So Saul goes in to relieve himself inside this cave. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. So Saul is chasing David. David and his men are inside this cave. Now, I don't know that all of David's men are in the cave. I don't know that the cave is big enough to house 600 guys and be very quiet. Okay, I mean, that seems like a pretty substantial cave. Maybe there's a cave there that big. I haven't been there yet. I don't know. But maybe there's 600 dudes all hanging out in this cave, and somehow they're all able to shush each other quiet enough so that when Saul comes in, he doesn't know that they're there. But we do know for a fact that David is there with some of his men, certainly. And when he goes into the cave and he exposes himself to such danger, see what I did there? And he's responding to this call of nature, David has this opportunity to do something to end this whole running away business. He's already lost his wife. He's already lost his best friend. He's already lost his home. He's already lost his wealth. He lost the sword that he normally would carry. Now he's carrying Goliath's sword, which is awesome, but not the sword he's most comfortable with. He's lost everything, and he has an opportunity now to finish this whole thing. Saul's there by himself, and David can do whatever he wants to kill Saul and to move this thing on. Now, listen. Every superhero slash action movie always has this scene in it to some degree, right? I mean, we've all seen it. There comes a point where the good guy gets the upper hand in every superhero movie. The bad guy is caught with the gun down and the good guy's got the gun pointed, right? Or the good guy is holding on to the wrist of the bad guy who's hanging over abyss. There's a lot of wrist holding over abysses in these movies, right? And there's always this point in every single action movie where the bad guy is at the mercy of the good guy. And what do you do internally, if not out loud, during those scenes? Do you do what I do? I say, kill him! I know he's unconscious on the ground. Pick up a gun and two in the chest, one in the head. Let's finish this movie right now. What are we worrying about? Hanging on for dear life. Just drop the guy. Does anybody else, do I have that many issues, or do you all feel that way too? My natural inclination is, this guy is trying to kill you for the whole movie. This guy has taken away everything that you own and everything that you are. Now you have a chance to just end it. And that's, in fact, what all the other guys in the cave think, except for David. So quietly, whispering in the back of the cave, they start talking to David. Here's the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hands, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. This is it! They're spiritualizing, right? God told you he was going to give you the kingdom. Now is the moment! And David arose and stealthily creeps forward, but he doesn't kill Saul. Saul's probably discarded his robe off to the side. David takes it and he cuts the corner off of it. His robe, which was a symbol of his authority, David takes a piece of it and he sneaks back deeper into the cave. Verse 5. After he cut off this corner of his robe, afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And he said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. So David persuaded his men with these words, and he did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Have you ever had one of those conscience-striking moments? It doesn't even make sense that your conscience is... all of your friends are you don't need to feel bad about that. What is your problem? I don't know. I just can't get it off my chest because I had said this stupid little lie. Yeah, but it didn't make any difference. Yeah, but it's just bothering me. Or they gave me a little bit too much money. Yeah, but that's a huge corporation. They can lose money. They probably stolen money in the past. It doesn't really... No, it bothers me. Here's David holding this shred of Saul's robe, and his conscience is pricked. And all the guys are going, David, I don't know if you understand how the math works here, but you're not the only one whose life is in danger. As soon as we signed up to be on Team David, we put ourselves in some serious trouble. He's not coming here just to kill you. He's going to kill all of us. Did you remember what he did to the priests? We're all dead men. And David says, I cannot lift my hand against the Lord's anointed. So he holds the shred of his robe, and out of the cave walks Saul. Afterward, David also arose,
And he went out of the cave, and he called after Saul, "My lord, the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks your harm'? Behold this day, your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. Some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand? For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you. But my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, 'Out of the wicked comes wickedness.' But my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? May the Lord therefore judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." As soon as David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and he wept. Saul has this moment. He walks out of the cave, and from behind him he hears, "Saul." He turns around, and David then kneels before him. And as he kneels before Saul, he begins to speak to him, and he tries to help him understand, listen, he's showing so much mercy. Not only that he didn't kill him, but even in his words, do you see the mercy there? "My Lord, my king, my father." This is his father-in-law. He had married Saul's daughter. He had gone to battle with this man. There was a real kinship between these two. He had maybe mentored David in some ways when David was a little bit younger. And he comes out and he says, "My father, how can you do this? How can you listen to these people who just want me out of the way? How can you listen to their lies? How can you come after me when all I've ever done is try to get your back?" And Saul begins to realize the situation. He had just avoided certain death. I imagine when he begins to weep, that he's shaking, that he's terrified, that he's afraid. Here's Saul. Do you remember how Saul was described? A head above everybody else, right? Head and shoulders taller than everybody else. Here is the greatest warrior in the land outside of David. Here's the man who's taller than everybody else, shaken to his very core by the fact that he was just shown mercy and could have been killed. My brother-in-law is an awesome dude. I told him I was going to share this story, but he's an awesome dude. And he's a big dude. He's about 6'2", 275, solid. Like, solid. Solid enough that my kids regularly ask me annoying questions like, "Dad, who's stronger, you or Uncle Al?" How do you answer a question like that? And so my answer is usually something along the lines of, "Well, Uncle Al is strong like the Incredible Hulk, but I'm strong like Captain America." And they go, "Oh, so he's stronger, huh?" But he's a dairy farmer, and there's this day when a bull attacked him, turned on him. And the very short version is that the bull came after him, and he ran to get out of the way by jumping into the feed trailer, and the bull stuck his head behind him, horns on either side, so it didn't skewer him, and flipped him up in the air. 275, just woof, right up in the air. And he flipped up, and he landed in the feed trailer. And as he did, the bull just snorted and kind of paced around the outside trying to get at him, and then eventually it went away. And I remember talking to him hours, maybe a day later. And I remember this larger-than-life, strong, Incredible Hulk sort of guy being so completely shaken by being so close to death. And I said, "See, kids, even the Incredible Hulk gets scared. What's up now, right?" I just remember him like going, "I was that close." The burgers tasted great, by the way. Saul was shaking. When Saul was weeping, he's going, "I was this close.
I am wearing, he's looking down at his own robe, realizing there's a missing chunk out of it. I came this close to losing my life. It was only the mercy of David that spared me. And so Saul has this moment where he realizes that he's been shown mercy. And he has this moment of clarity. He said to David, "You're more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." You see it? He's actually seeing in David what God saw in David. He's looking at David going, "I see you're the better man. I can tell you're the type of king that Israel needs. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." And David shows him mercy again. He swore to Saul. Then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. In this story, we see the look of mercy and the source of mercy, and we'll talk too about the people and the joy of mercy. What does mercy look like? What does it look like? Well, in this story, it looks like respect for people that don't deserve it. If you think about what mercy is, it is giving respect to someone because of their rank or just simply because of who they are, not because they are particularly deserving of it. Mercy looks like respect. And this cuts against something that is so fundamentally American about many of us. We are so Western that we believe that it is our duty to cut people down. It is our duty to criticize everybody and to not let something go without saying something about it, because I'm an American and hear me roar. But mercy is respect. And I understand that this is nuanced, but there is this call to respect all over the Bible. There's a whole lot more call to respect than freedom of speech. The Bible regularly talks about respect, and in this case, mercy looks like respect to someone who doesn't deserve it. What else does mercy look like? Mercy looks like strength. Mercy looks like strength to confront. See, I think sometimes the reason we don't like mercy or why it seems so weak is because we think of like a manager at work and his employee isn't doing their job and he's costing the company lots of money and he's lazy and he's whatever. And that manager just goes, "I guess I should be merciful. I won't say anything." That's not mercy. That's weakness. That's foolishness. David here doesn't just go, "I'm not going to say anything." He walks out of the cave with strength. Who's the strong one now? David might be bowing, but he's the strong one. When he walks out of the cave, he confronts Saul. He says, "Respectfully, my lord, my king, my father." But he also says, "What are you doing? It's not right. I could have killed you. I need to confront you, but I'm going to still show you mercy." His mercy in that scenario confronts, but is also strong. He corrects the wrong that's been said, but he also does it with love. A few weeks back, there was a video circulating about white supremacist idiot was speaking somewhere, and there's like his four or five supporters or whatever, and there was a whole mob of people that were there to protest this person. And the video is circulating because there's this one guy with a shaved head and his little suspenders or whatever, And he's just surrounded by people who don't agree with the premise of why he's there. And they're all shouting at him. And they're like screaming stuff. You hear the videos. Wah, rah, 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 a lot of pointing. Rah, 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 rah. Somebody even takes a kind of a swing at him. And he's just standing there, proud of his ignorance, I guess. And there's this one guy who walks up to him, right in the middle of all this crowd. And his name's Courtney, and he's this black guy with these dreads. And he walks up to him. I don't know if you saw this video or not. But he walks up not in weakness, in strength, and he shows this guy mercy. And he goes, "Why do you hate me? Give me a hug." And the guy's just standing there. And so he hugs him. And he goes, why do you hate me? Is it my skin? Is it my dreadlocks? Is it, you know, what is it? Is it my history? What is it about me that you hate? And the guy's just trying to, like, look past him, and he hugs him again. And he's still talking to him. Now, it's strong, isn't it? Why do you, what's your problem? I'm right here. And the guy's just kind of standing there. And the third time, he leans in and hugs him. He goes, why do you hate me? And he hugs him a third time. And the third time in the video, you can see the guy's arms go back up around him. And he said he felt like God was saying in his ear, you just changed his life. What is mercy? Well, it's respect to people that don't deserve it. Case in point right there, right? Mercy is also strength. It's strength to confront, but to confront with love, not just crushing fists of justice. That's what mercy looks like. It looks like David respecting a man who doesn't deserve it, and yet strongly confronting what's wrong. What's the source of mercy? If that's what mercy, if that's the look of mercy, what is the source of mercy? For David, his merciful spirit, and we see this played out again and again. He's merciful to this fool king, and then the next chapter, he's merciful to this guy whose name is basically fool, and then he ends up being merciful again to Saul, the fool king, in just a couple chapters. For him, this trust in God's sovereignty and faithfulness was where he found his mercy. But for us, where does our source of real mercy come from? If we want to be like David, how do we have mercy? See, here's the challenge, I think. And this is the part that for me went, ooh. If we simply want to be like David by putting ourselves in his shoes, we will never be truly merciful. We will only begin to be really merciful when we realize that in this story of the two characters, who are we? Saul. Did you realize that? We're Saul. We're the idiot kings with our little tiny crowns over our little kingdoms think, I'm in charge. I'm in control. Anybody who ever tries to affront my little kingdom, I get angry at, even if it's God. That's who we are in the story, my friends. We are the guy trying to hang on to a foolish kingdom that's perishing when the true king is trying to break into our lives. So what's the source of mercy? This is so hard for us to grasp. C.S. Lewis said this, "The ancient man approached God, or even the gods, as the accused person approaches his judge. For the modern man, the roles are quite reversed. Man is the judge, and God is in the dock. Man is quite a kindly judge if God should have a reasonable defense for being the God who permits war, poverty, disease. Man's ready to listen to it. The trial may even end in God's acquittal, but the important thing is that man is on the bench and God is in the dock." What is the source of mercy? The source of mercy is when we recognize that we are trying to be kings, and yet we only live and breathe and have our being because of Christ the King. Romans 5 says, while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps the good person, one would even dare to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The source of real mercy is when we stop running around with delusions that we are the arbiters of all justice, that we are the kings and queens whose kingdoms ultimately matter. The source of real mercy is throwing ourselves on the mercies of Christ, whose mercies are new every single day. Jesus chose mercy for us. So instead of deluding ourselves that we're David's, we must embrace the reality that we're Saul. And when that happens, we can overflow the mercy that's been shown to us. What does mercy look like? It looks like respect to people that don't deserve it. It looks like the strength to confront. What is the source of mercy? Recognizing that we're Saul rather than that we're David, and that we need Christ's redemption and sacrifice. Who are the people of mercy? Who are the people that you are called to show mercy to? My thought is that I could give you 5 steps. Here's how to be merciful, but it's probably better off to help you think of who in your life do you need to be merciful toward. So who are the people right now? Who comes to mind? If I say there's a person in your life to whom you should be showing mercy, who comes to mind? For some of you, that may be an advisor or a boss. Because guess what? They don't deserve you. And all your hard work, you know, some of it that they've tried to steal. You know, all the extra hours that they don't acknowledge. You know, all the thank you cards you didn't get. They deserve your mercy. Well, maybe they don't deserve your mercy. They ought to get your mercy. What about the crabby neighbor or patient? You know the patient I'm talking about. Their family doesn't even come see them. They're such a pain. Does that person, the person to whom you should be showing mercy? How about a public figure? Is there a public figure out there that you have a tough time being merciful towards? I can think of a couple. Is there a public figure that maybe we ought to consider, I don't respect them, they haven't earned my respect, but somehow I'm supposed to show them respect? What about your parents? What about your parents? I think some of the hardest people that we have in our lives to show our mercy toward are our parents, because they should know better. And here's the thing. Some of your parents might be lousy. I have no idea. And you might go, if you only knew what they did to me, then you wouldn't tell me I should be merciful toward them. Fair enough. Just in your anger there. Does it compare to this? Did they take away your spouse and your best friend in your home and then throw a spear at you 3 times? If so, we want to capture your video for one of our grace stories up here, because that would be amazing. But really, I don't know what they did. I don't. I'm just saying that when you trust the sovereignty and the sacrifice of Jesus, even our parents ought to be the recipients of our mercy. The look of mercy, the source of mercy, the people of mercy, and lastly, the joy of mercy. Proverbs 11:17 says, "The merciful man does good to his own soul, but he that is cruel troubles his own flesh." Matthew 5:7 says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." A lot of times that blessed gets translated as happy. Happy are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. There's a tremendous freedom in playing the game that's set before us and letting God be the coach and the ref. If you want to be miserable, be merciless. If you want to be a miserable human being, choose to be a merciless human being. Make sure that every slight, every wrong, every injustice is something that you categorize and put in your head. Keep score constantly. Do that, and you'll be miserable. Some of you may have seen Michael Jordan's Hall of Fame speech. You look at a guy who's recognized as the greatest basketball player who's ever lived. He's got more money than any of us can imagine. Good-looking dude, you know, the whole package, right? And yet, he spent half of that speech just recounting all these slights and showing the chip on his shoulder. And I thought, what a miserable dude. Today is the day you should just be like, yes, I'm in the hall. This is awesome. And yet, he's hanging on to all of those things. Mercilessness is a recipe for turmoil, frustration, anger, and dissatisfaction. Christ has showed us a better way. The way that throws itself on the mercy of God and then overflows that mercy to others is the life that is happy and joyful. And according to Christ, it's blessed. For they shall receive mercy. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the mercy you've extended to us. We can only ever be a people that show mercy by first receiving it from you. So God, I ask that you would allow us to overflow with mercy. Allow us to be the people that show others mercy, that show others respect, that forgive, that are compassionate, that are caring. God, as we have an opportunity to take communion together, would you allow us to remember the mercy shown to us through the great and powerful work of Christ on the cross? Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.